Okay, I think we should get rolling. I know we're going to have some other folks arriving here shortly, but I think we should get started. And that is, this is our state and federal legislative agenda work session. We're going to be joined, I think, shortly by Mayor-elect Wheeler. I understand Commissioner-elect Daley is ill and will not be joining us, but we'll give them a chance to...
Commissioner-elect Daley.
That's what I said.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. We'll be joining us. Later in the process. Anyway, with that, this is a work session. We don't need to take a roll call, and we'll call up Martha Nils and Vicki and get started. So good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. For the record, Martha Pellegrino, Director of the Office of Government Relations. My team and I are very pleased to be before you today. I'm going to keep moving back. I'll be back there if you need me. And we're pleased to bring you the first drafts of the state and federal legislative agendas for 2017. And for today's format, as the mayor mentioned, we will start by providing some context for the political climate in Washington, D.C., and then we'll walk through some of the top line items in the draft agenda. After the presentation, we're happy to answer questions, and then we'll turn to the state legislative agenda. Really very pleased to bring back Vicki Cram from our Washington, D.C. representative, and Neil Stillstrom, our Senior Associate of Federal Affairs. Just a quick note on the process for building the agenda thus far. We began back in September with a call to each of the city bureaus and offices for issues that they expect will be major federal city issues in the coming Congress. Several bureaus submitted concepts for inclusion based on important policy and funding connections, and we've been working with the bureaus and offices to refine those proposals over the last few months. We've also been keeping in close contact with the city's federal congressional delegation and working with them on efforts about bills they're planning to advance in the coming Congress. So with that, I'd like to turn things over to Vicki Cram to begin our presentation.
Sorry, thank you. So we have a new day in Washington, D.C., and on January 20th, President Trump will be sworn into office. On January 3rd, the 115th Congress will be sworn in, and they will start work immediately. Usually they take a couple of weeks off in between swearing in and the inauguration, but this year they're going to start because they've got a lot to do in the first 100 days. The Republican Party regained control over both chambers. The U.S. Senate is 51-48, with one seat still to be decided, and that seat's in Louisiana and will be decided on December 10th, and that's a pickup of two Democratic seats, we anticipate. And the U.S. House of Representatives is 239-194, with two seats still to be decided, which again are in Louisiana on the December 10th date. And that is the pickup of about six Democratic seats. I do think it's important to note that 60 votes are still needed in the Senate to pass most legislation except for budget reconciliation, which is a term we use, which is a fast-track budget measure that may be used to repeal, in this case, portions of the Affordable Care Act or potentially advance tax reform in the next year. And that only needs this budget reconciliation process, only needs a simple majority to move forward. Our Oregon delegation, we have a slide on that now. As we know, they're hardworking, dedicated, and well-placed delegation with seniority in their respective parties. I'm just going to draw attention to those who will be involved, I think most primarily, in some of the issues that we'll be seeing in the first rollout of the 100 days. One is Senator Ron Wyden, who, as we know, is the ranking member on the Finance Committee and will be very involved in tax reform legislation. Senator Merkley, who serves on the Appropriations Committee. There will be a lot of budget battles that will be coming up early in the new year, and he'll be very involved in those. Congressman Greg Walden, who was just elected chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House, and that committee will be very engaged in whatever repeal and replace happens to the Affordable Care Act. Congressman Blumenauer, very senior on the Ways and Means Committee, again, tax reform. And Congressman Peter DeFazio, ranking member of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. And of course, President-elect Trump has talked about infrastructure packages. And so that he will be very, very involved in whatever we move forward on infrastructure. Our next slide has known cabinet nominees, not all of them, but some of the key ones that have been proposed by the president-elect. They obviously need to be confirmed by the Senate. And there may be a tough fight over a couple of the nominees that he will be putting forward.
Does the Senate, is that a simple majority vote or is 60 again?
I believe that's a 60 vote.
Thank you.
But I will double check and get back to you on that. Our next slide has some key federal successes over the last year. One, of course, is the every year we have a fight about the Urban Area Security Initiative and try to ensure that the city of Portland gets funded. So this year we got $3 million to the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. We were, of course, Smart Cities Initiative finalists, collaborating with a lot of equity partners and five partner cities. And the mayor, Mayor Hales, and Mayor-elect Wheeler, and the Portland Bureau of Transportation were all very involved in promoting that. I think a lot of good will come of that. It put us on the map for autonomous vehicles and a lot of smart cities technology issues moving forward. The Water Resources Development Act, which is being considered right now in the lame duck session of Congress, we have included Tryon Creek and other Willamette River restoration projects in both the House and the Senate versions. So we are sure that we will get authorization for those projects in this bill. And then we were successful with a number of grant proposals with funding for domestic victims of domestic violence, $728,000. We supported the Work System $6 million America's Promise grant. And then some unconventional funding sources like the U.S. Conference of Mayors, $300,000 grant for Blanchet House of Hospitality. We also worked very closely with Mayor Hales and with the other mayors on the West Coast to form the West Coast Mayors Alliance, which will be an ongoing project for West Coast mayors to get together annually and move additional issues of importance to all jurisdictions forward. We worked with other cities and with our delegation and with congressional committees to pass the FAST Act, which is the Surface Transportation Act, and also the Bipartisan Housing Opportunities Through Modernization Act. So those are most of the key successes. There's some others here that you can review in terms of collaborations and positions that we've taken. We are currently in a lame duck session of Congress right now. And first I want to talk about the continuing resolution. Congress only passed one of its appropriations bills through the regular order in the year. So the federal fiscal year started October 1, and we are now operating the federal government on a continuing resolution, which funds programs at FY16 levels. And that continuing short-term continuing resolution expires on Friday, December 9th. They are drafting a CR right now. We actually expect we will see a new one today. I haven't seen it out yet. Which will keep programs again at the FY16 levels through until we think the end of April. And that will allow the new Congress and the new president to take up the FY17 funding process. We think that it may have a couple of add-ons like funding for Flint, Michigan water contamination and potentially California drought relief and Louisiana flood relief attached to it. And then also being dealt with in the, and we hope that that will be passed by the end of this week, and Congress will probably adjourn that. But also on their agenda is the Water Resources Development Act, which I mentioned earlier. This is an authorizing bill for Army Corps of Engineers projects, and it includes the Willamette River restoration projects such as Tryon Creek. And the Corps and the city will share an estimated cost of about $30 million over a number of years to improve 123 acres of riparian backwater habitat and wetlands. And another bill that is actually on the Senate floor today, it passed the House last week, is something called the 21st Century Cures Act. and it will include $4.77 billion in new funding for the National Institutes of Health over 10 years, including Vice President Biden's cancer moonshot. It will also have $1 billion to address the opioid epidemic, and then there are some mental health reform provisions that are being folded into it, mainly about supportive services for prisoners in their reentry. But once this bill gets passed, and if it's not amended, we will send you an update on what's in it. And I know that a number of you are very interested in particular the mental health provisions. And we think that that bill will pass in the lame duck session of Congress. There's one other bill. It's an energy package that they've been going back and forth on in conference to resolve differences between the House and the Senate. And there may actually be a very limited energy bill that comes out of this lame duck session. In terms of the 115th Congress, and we have some of the key budget dates up here for you on our PowerPoint, President-elect Trump's priorities for the 115th Congress are border security, repeal of the Affordable Care Act, and the economy. His agenda will provide challenges and opportunities for the city of Portland. On the federal budget appropriations front, as I mentioned previously, the continuing resolution, which will fund federal programs at FY16 levels, will expire at the end of April. Concurrently, the administration and Congress will begin the FY18 budget and appropriations process. And the key dates for that, or at least the key target dates for that, it always slides, are on the slide that we have up there. As the FY15 continuing resolution, the one they're working on right now, expires in April, the nation's borrowing authority, also known as the debt ceiling, will expire around March. The Treasury Department can employ accounting measures to delay it for a month or two, but they will have to deal with that, and there is a potential for budget cuts or offsets to raise the debt ceiling. It's unclear at this point how these budget issues will be resolved, but we will continue to fight hard, especially working with Senator Merkley, who serves on the Appropriations Committee, to protect funding for cities' priorities like housing, homelessness, transportation, discretionary funding, etc. One other thing I need to note about the FY18 budget process. So the FY17 budget process will come due as the debt ceiling expires. The FY18 budget process brings back sequestration across the board cuts. So absent some large funding deal, there's the potential for some serious cuts. Among one of the key programs which we advocate for in the appropriations process every year is the Urban Area Security Initiative, which I mentioned earlier. And we received $3 million to build capacity to prevent, respond to, and recover from natural disasters and terrorism, and it's administered by the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. Every year, we seek to include language in the Department of Homeland Security appropriations bills to allow cities like Portland, and we know acts of terrorism can strike anywhere now, to be funded under the program. We also work with the Department of Homeland Security every year on reviewing our annual data, which changes every year and affects our ranking relative to other cities nationwide, and hence determines whether we get funded or not. We will continue to strongly advocate for this funding in the FY17 and FY18 appropriations processes. With relation to border security and sanctuary cities, Mayor-elect. We talked a little bit about our successes over the past year. You can see them on the document you have before you. And we are now talking about anticipated 115th Congress actions. And we talked a little bit about the appropriations process and the Urban Area Security Initiative. And I'm now sort of moving into border security and sanctuary city issues. President-elect Trump has stated that he will remove all federal funding from so-called sanctuary cities. In the past year, Congress has attempted to pass legislation, and many bills were introduced, that would restrict funding from so-called sanctuary cities or political jurisdictions considered to be in violation of 8 U.S.C. Section 1373. Section 1373 restricts local law enforcement from implementing policies that prohibit the sharing of an individual's immigration information with the federal government. The City of Portland is currently compliant with Section 1373. At this point, it's too early to tell how this will unfold. Various bills introduced on this subject in the 114th Congress this past year included very broad definitions of a sanctuary city, and each bill applied different discrete penalties, such as the loss of the Community Development Block Grant funds or Department of Justice funds or other funds. Many of the definitions in these bills could penalize jurisdictions which implement standard policing practices to protect public safety. We followed this issue very closely, and we will continue to follow it very closely in the coming year and work with all of you on this issue as it rolls out and as we see what Congress intends to do. On the economy, infrastructure, and tax reform, President-elect Trump has proposed a $1 trillion infrastructure package. We've only seen the broad outlines at this point, and of course Congress will have to refine and revise the package to take it up under consideration. As it currently stands, the infrastructure proposal relies heavily on public-private partnerships and tax credits, which likely cannot result entirely in the broad kind of infrastructure package spanning surface transportation, ports, aviation, water, sewer, broadband, potentially energy grid, that is envisioned by the president at this point. Discussion has already started in some circles about longer-term funding mechanisms, such as raising the gas tax or other means of funding such a package to pay for such a robust program. There will also be a push towards tax reform in this Congress. Potentially, tax reform could pay for a portion of the infrastructure package, but it may be a vehicle for repatriation of overseas taxes or reduction in tax rates. Regardless, tax reform could endanger some of local government's most important tools, such as the tax-exempt status of municipal bonds, the low-income housing tax credit, and new markets tax credit. On the other hand, it might also provide an opportunity to include bike share as a transit benefit, which is something that Congressman Blumenauer has worked on very strongly, or potentially be the vehicle for expansion of the low-income housing tax credit, as was proposed this year by Senators Cantwell of Washington and Senator Wyden. Finally, we anticipate a rollback of many regulations and executive orders promulgated during the Obama administration, many of which, like the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the Clean Power Plan, the Waters of the U.S., and others, are already in the courts right now. Before I turn this over to Niels Tillstrom to talk about the draft of the agenda, I want to thank you for your engagement and support in our advocacy efforts, and we look forward to working with you to advance the city's agenda next year.
Niels, go ahead. I've got a couple I want to stir into the...
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So thank you, Mr. Mayor, Mr. Mayor-elect, the council. My name is Niels Tillstrom. I'm the Federal Relations Manager for the City of Portland on the Office of Government Relations. So the draft federal legislative agenda that we bring to you today has four draft priorities. And I'll go through them, and then we'll move on to the other themes in the document. The first being affordable housing, homelessness, and support services. This item is to guide us to support programs that advance the mission of the Portland Housing Bureau, our partners at the county and community-based organizations, to provide affordable housing stock, homeless services, and supportive services to keep people either out of homelessness, to bring them back into the workforce. The second item is sanctuary cities, and Vicki spoke to this pretty thoroughly, but the city will oppose legislation and administrative actions to limit the eligibility for federal funding based on our sanctuary city status.
Can I just ask a question about that?
Yeah.
As we all know, we're a sanctuary state because of state law rising out of the appeals courts. Has the administration or the future administration made any comments or about that rather than the individual cities?
Not clearly, except I think that California...
So the future administration is not given us much indication as to where they're going to go on this, other than the statement that they want to remove all federal funds from sanctuary cities. This administration, Department of Justice, had an Inspector General report where they reviewed the status of a number of jurisdictions, all jurisdictions around the country, and they determined that there were 10 jurisdictions that could stand to have further review. And amongst those jurisdictions was the state of California, which has a more robust sanctuary law than Oregon does, I believe, and the state of Connecticut, and then they singled out 8 other jurisdictions. So we were not singled out in that for further review by this administration. So whether that is the starting point for the next administration or for Congress has yet to be determined. But right now, we have not been singled out, at least by this administration.
And the state of California and the state of Connecticut. They have not been singled out either?
Pardon me?
Those states haven't actually suffered any loss of funding so far.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Thank you.
No. So the third item, Urban Area Security Initiative, which Vicky spoke to, the UASI program, we refer to it as UASI, helps the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management build the capacity for the region's preparedness to a terrorist attack, natural disaster, or catastrophic event. And Vicky spoke to our process going through each year, helping to build the case for Portland's inclusion in the funding list for that program. The last item is municipal bonds, and put quite simply, municipal bonds are a vital tool to build cities. We use them to build transportation infrastructure, water infrastructure, sewer infrastructure, schools, and the city opposes changes to federal tax law that would impact the cost to fund those projects.
Niels, to jump back to UASI for a minute.
Sure.
In the past, we've sort of relied on the fact that we were, when they were like figuring out how many cities were eligible, we were always close to Las Vegas. We were counting on Harry Reid to protect Las Vegas and therefore to save us in the process. Now that Harry Reid isn't going to be there anymore, does Donald Trump have casinos in Vegas itself?
He has a hotel there.
Now I really have a question.
Yeah. I really hope that's true, so that he'll have some interest in Las Vegas getting his fund.
We'll take all things under account. Yeah. Moving from our draft priorities.
Let me throw a couple things into the mix there. One, Donald Trump has talked a lot about a lot of subjects. I don't remember hearing the subject of municipal bonds come up. Maybe I missed it. So do we think the threat about municipal bonds or their deductibility and so forth is rising or falling, or do we not know?
Mayor, can I jump in on that one for a sec? Because it's actually a priority of our senior senator. And he has been a champion in the Senate of limiting the deductibility for high income purchasers. And the problem with that is it would change the market and would potentially affect interest rates. And that's not an incidental matter, since the Water Bureau with a AAA credit rating just yesterday went out and the bond market got exceptionally favorable rates because of low interest rates and our AAA credit rating.
Yeah.
But if I could just also piggyback on your question, there's the senator recently issued a statement saying he was looking forward to bipartisan tax reform. Does bipartisan tax reform, to the mayor's point, include changes to municipal finance deductibility?
I think it well could. And I think one of the things to remember about the municipal bonds market is it's one of the top 10 revenue generators. So if you are crafting a tax package where you want to lower rates on corporations or individuals or whatever, you're going to be looking for funds to offset those cuts. And that's where I think we are most endangered, because it's one of the top 10 revenue generators, along with the mortgage interest deduction. But also capping municipal bonds, which is something that actually this administration has proposed every year for the last 8 years in their budget, last 7 years in their budget, at 28%, is also very detrimental to the market.
And so you think, because they're going to be on a revenue hunt without raising taxes, that they might be, the Trump administration might be interested in that?
I think, we have a strong argument in terms of infrastructure, and if the president wants to promote infrastructure, this is one of the ways enhancing, you know, keeping, preserving municipal bond tax exempt status as well.
What we often hear, Mayor, is, you know, wealthy people should not get this tax break. The problem is, absent a replacement system that allows us to borrow at very favorable rates, the net effect of this so-called reform effort is to drive up our cost of borrowing. So it's has a very unfavorable consequence to cities across the country.
So let me appreciate that discussion. So we think that threat might actually rise rather than recede. Okay.
And on that, no, Mayor, we did actually an analysis of a project that took a lot of regional collaboration a few years back, and that was the Selwood Bridge, mm-hmm. That required state partnership, local partnership, and federal partnership. And we ran the numbers about how much more each jurisdiction would have to pay. How much more money would the city and county have to come up with? How much more would the state have to come up with? How much more would the feds have to put in with each of those proposals? And in very clear numbers, you can see how does this project that requires every level of government to put it together, how much more it would cost, even with a cap on the muni bonds rate. So I think we have great examples that we can bring to our delegation of why they need to keep fighting for this, because the federal resources aren't on the increase, they're on the decrease. And it takes intergovernmental cooperation in order for these projects to move forward.
So let me mention a couple things at this juncture. One is the priorities. No quarrel with those four. They all make sense to me. I might suggest that council think about another one, which is transportation funding, in particular on a couple of grounds. One, I recounted to the professional team here, I'll mention to you, my colleagues, that Mayor Garcetti had a conversation with President-elect Trump, which was interesting just to think about, but also reported that in the conversation, the President-elect said something to this effect of, well, we give transportation money to the states, should we give it to the cities instead? Now, at one level, that's a bizarre question because they've always done it the other way, right? But at a second level, it's maybe illustrative of the fact that there are many concerns and problems with President Trump. Even saying those words is problematic for me. The fact that he would think anew about that question is an opportunity and therefore should be regarded as such and the opportunity hopefully expanded. So he's interested in building stuff. He's interested in building infrastructure, and he might be interested in bypassing the states and giving money to cities. That's not bad news if that all turns out to be true. A more particular question that I want to make sure to plant in your thoughts, and that is one thing that's been bipartisan most of the time over the long run of our work on transit process, the agreements that the federal government provides for building a new transit project, that's always been bankable. That if you get a full funding grant agreement from the Federal Transit Administration in the, you know, Bush administration, the Clinton administration finished paying for it, and so on over the years. So it is very much in the city of Portland's interest that that process continue to work, that for the next transit project, whether it's the Division Powell Corridor or Barber or whatever it is, that the deal is still the deal. So I would urge you to keep an eye on that particular ingredient of the transportation picture, that regardless of the level of funding, regardless of whether they continue to funnel it through states to cities or whether they, better yet, give it to you directly, the question of can we still build transit projects and count on the federal government to give us half the capital cost is a big deal. So it's not directly the city's concern, but look back on all the last few federally funded transportation projects and remember how much city money went into the capital stack on the local side. And you see my point. A couple other particulars I would urge you to watch. One, the Unity Center is going to open on January 5th. I was over there yesterday. It's better than I hoped it would be. It's really going to be great. That center got built in part because the Affordable Care Act gave the hospitals reason to do it that way, to spend $45 million of their money and, what, $7 million or so or $6 million of public money from the counties and the city. It's very much in the community's interest that the incentives and disincentives that cause the hospitals to spend all that money to build that thing continue, and that we don't go through another cycle where we have a mental hospital in Portland that opens and then closes again, particularly when it's state-of-the-art and where our police officers and firefighters are going to be taking people in mental health crisis to a truly humane and effective facility. So I want to flag that one because we're the small dog in that sled team, but we sure like where the sled's going, if I could stick with the metaphor. And then finally, the third one I would mention in particular as a, maybe it's not specifically listed, but we've housed 800 homeless veterans because of the generous provision of VASH vouchers through the VA and HUD. That's worked extraordinarily well. And so one thing, maybe again, good progressives like us and conservative Republicans can agree on is that taking good care of our veterans and getting them off the street and into affordable, decent housing units is a national priority for everyone and might be another case in which cities and the new administration can build some common ground because that's really worked.
And could I just add on to the, especially on the healthcare issue, obviously if Affordable Care Act goes away, then lots of young people and potentially lots of older folks who might, there's talk about getting rid of Medicare. So I think these are kind of, you know these are our priorities and maybe they don't have to be on the list, but I think they really should be, along with reproductive rights and particularly continuing Oregon's making universal contraceptives available. I was reading there was a 10% increase or tenfold increase in women applying for IUDs because they're worried that other forms of contraception won't be available to them.
Yeah. Good.
On the Affordable Care Act again, I think that, I mean, one big concern is that they will do what they said they're going to do, which is repeal it but keep the popular parts. In other words, insurers will still have to provide coverage of people with pre-existing conditions, which could result in the entire health insurance market collapsing because they'd have to charge insane rates to everybody in order to deal with that. So I actually wonder if there might be some advantage to some progressive entities going on record as saying, if you're going to repeal it, repeal the whole thing. Just make it quite clear how disastrous the political gamesmanship with it would be.
To the next slide. Are you just going to whip through this?
I'm going to whip through this, yes. That's my next step. So the rest of the agenda, we have divided up into draft policy themes. Protecting local decision-making, investing in vital infrastructure, and providing public safety and resiliency. And I was going to touch on just a handful of these and then open it up to discussion and welcome any questions. The first item that I wanted to discuss was the city's response to the National Flood Insurance Program's compliance with the Endangered Species Act. And that is also goes under another name as the FEMA BIOP. That's maybe, you know, I could go deeper on that. The FEMA BIOP is a process of an interplay between two federal agencies that could potentially impact a role in all future development in the city of Portland and also hundreds of communities across Oregon. And so we are working with other stakeholders, other levels of government, and communicating to the delegation our process to comply with the intermediate steps that this BIOP is laying out, and we are will be working with the delegation to make sure they understand how they could play a role in providing for different levels of flood mapping or different pressure points that they could help this process move along to provide some certainty for local governments. And the next one I'd like to touch on is climate change and energy policy, and that is focused on really protecting the good work that the city and the county have done over the years in cutting carbon emissions through our climate action plans. And we have spoken about this from all mountaintops almost, we want to make sure that there is no, in the next administration, we want to make sure there is no interference or preemptions placed on state and local governments that are doing the right thing. The next component I wanted to, or piece I want to talk about in investing in vital infrastructure is Vision Zero, and Council took action on this very recently. And this item, the shorthand of it is the city will support discretionary funds to cities to implement their Vision Zero plans to provide for safer streets for all road users in an effort to reach the goal of zero fatalities on the roads. The next item is federal infrastructure for federal investment in urban infrastructure. Excuse me. This goes back to a number of points that you made, Mr. Mayor, on transportation, on New Starts process, and this is supporting programs that send monies to cities and municipalities, be it New Starts, Small Starts, Tiger Grant, the Fast Lane, which is a freight focused piece, and other programs. I think those are things we can identify projects regionally that would fit into any of those categories. It depends really on how this transportation infrastructure package rolls out, whether or not we'll have the ability to take advantage of those projects. If it's a tax issue versus if it's funding like the a tax incentives versus funding like it was in the Recovery Act. Then the last item I want to talk to you and then open it up is the Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup. And this is an ongoing and complicated issue, and the city has, plays several different roles in this, both as a regulator and then also provides for the both public good and the river's good. But in the draft, we are supporting a timely release of a record of decision, and we'll work with state and local stakeholders to make sure that this process continues to move forward.
Mayor, I have a couple of questions and comments. First, as to Superfund, council will remember that we have been pushing for a timely record of decision. We got some pushback from some folks in the community who didn't want to put the EPA in the position of rushing. In light of the election results, I think we're all united in wanting to get the record of decision as quickly as possible. And our hope is that will issue sometime the first 2 weeks in January. There is no longer, as Commissioner Novick has noted in the past, there's no longer a fund component of Superfund. And the one big change that we're going to see, at least from what I've been reading in the paper, is there is a strong view among some in Washington that rejects the idea of polluter pays. And so we'll have to see how that plays out, particularly since as a potentially responsible party, we are jointly and severally liable here. And so, anyway, our hope is there's a rod sooner rather than later. It'd be nice if it was in the first couple of weeks of January. But the landscape is changing, and it'd be interesting to see how that changes the apportionment of responsibility. The one thing the city has been concerned about is not standing in the shoes of other polluters who should pay their fair share simply because there's a joint several liability regime. Second, can I add something to just something for you to track, Vicki, which is any updates to the lead and copper rule? And obviously post-Flint, that has been a big national conversation, but there is also a local opportunity I think we should keep our eye on, which is some talk of allowing states to use federal money in a more flexible way to fund something that I talked to the mayor about recently, and actually he's the originator of this idea, to use flexible federal money to work with homeowners to actually remove bad plumbing and bad pipes. So rather than look for a 100-year plan to how to mitigate the impact of water mixing with bad plumbing, bad pipes, think about a pilot where we could actually get it out of people's homes in a cost-effective way. And, of course, as Charlie noted in our conversation, we already do that through Clean Energy Works and other things. So there is a model, and that actually solves the problem. So we think there's going to be some appetite in Washington to look at that, and I think there may be an opportunity for Oregon and Portland to be a pilot on that. Two questions for you. One is Congressman Blumenauer has made no secret of his desire to get marijuana off Schedule 1. That has a lot of consequences if he's successful. I guess one question to you, Vicki, is does the change that's occurred in Washington make that more likely or less likely? And the second question is, the administration, the new administration, has expressed a potentially desire to repeal Davis-Bacon. Now, the local version of Davis-Bacon, of course, the state version, was Governor Attia's legislative priority. I guess the question is, and we have had this conversation locally, colleagues, because some who have argued we could lower the cost of affordable housing have included in their list reducing the wages and benefits we pay to the people who build houses. So there's a fairness issue. My question, though, is if is Davis-Bacon in the bullseye? And if so, how does that trickle down to us with respect to federal funds that we might use to do things like build affordable housing?
Let me start with your first question on marijuana. again, it's awfully early to tell how some of this is going to play out. I know that the president-elect has said that he thinks that medical marijuana is a good idea. The incoming nominee for Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has been very vocal about not supporting marijuana. We just had an election where a number of states just came onto the rosters with either medical or recreational marijuana. We're getting to the point where it's sort of a tipping point in terms of the numbers of states who have some kind of legislation on the books. So, you know, I hate to sort of say we don't know, but I think that there may be a little bit of wiggle room in this, and it's just a little too early to tell. On the repeal of Davis-Bacon, I think that's, I haven't seen that in like the first level of things that they may want to go after. I would not be surprised if it wasn't on a second tier list, both for Congress and the administration.
So there's a question that we'll ask for some guidance later, which is if we get federal funds that are no longer have a Davis-Bacon requirement, can the state of Oregon do an overlay as to how those money is spent, or can the federal government preempt, and does it change how we view determining area standards in any federal project, any project funded with federal dollars?
On the marijuana issue, I think that some folks in the Republican leadership realize that a large number of people feel like the only way they can get through a Trump administration is to be stoned out of their gourds at all time. And they think that that might be good because otherwise they might turn to open opposition. So I think there will be actually a big push in the Republican leadership in Congress, at least, to say full steam ahead, marijuana for everybody.
Emphasize.
Now, that was it for the agenda right now. I want to turn it back to Martha. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, guidance about the federal portion of this agenda? Ted, anything you want to add?
First of all, on the infrastructure question, that's one that's near and dear to my heart, and I think we should at least be prepared for the possibility that infrastructure funding could be funded on a competitive basis. And I would particularly expect something around return on investment or local or state leverage as being a key component of any federal funding associated with an infrastructure package. And what that probably means translated is we should expect more tolling and more privatization of infrastructure. And there's models already in place around the world where that is the case. And at some point, we're going to have a conversation as a council, and we're going to have conversations with our state and our federal delegation about what that means and where we are with regard to our opinions on that kind of a framework. I like the mayor and Commissioner Fish's comments around lead pipes. I think you're being proactive, and I think that's super smart. I'll just put one more idea into the mix. I like the mayor's idea. I would add another idea, which is a low to zero interest revolving loan fund. You could potentially extend the loan, have the remediation done, and collect on the loan at the sale of the house or something like that. There's other ways we could look at that, but I think it's a great idea. I expect HUD to further retreat on Section 8. That's been a critical program here. This city council has certainly acknowledged and understood the importance of Section 8 historically, in terms of keeping families in their homes. We need to go to bat for that. And I think when we get to the state piece, we should talk about what we can do at the state level as a potential enhancement of federal Section 8 vouchers, creating or looking at resources we have potentially here at the state level. I don't recall much conversation around the mental health piece, but that's really important, and I got here late and I probably missed that. We are the recipients at the local level of the mental health problems, and I really applaud the mayor and the city council for their work around the Unity Center with the counties and the health providers and others. And I agree with the mayor's concerns around that. I think those are very, very valid concerns. We also need to clean up our act closer to home. I'm concerned about the state budget and its implications. And if there's just simply a cost shift from the state to local government to the Unity Center, and if these guys went through all that work to create a Unity Center, I don't want to see a state cut immediately swamp that local service that was provided for a different purpose entirely.
Be worried about that. The Unity Center folks are worried about the state closing facilities and having those patients dumped on this facility. Oh, you got a brand new hospital. Thank you.
One comment, Ted and colleagues. We love vouchers, and we love the principle behind vouchers, but our Section 8 program is below 70% utilization right now because there are no units to rent. And the problem is, if we just have these market-based tools from Washington, and thank God Republican senators support low-income tax credits and Section 8 vouchers, and we love them. Unfortunately, in an environment where there are no vacancies and no affordable units, we're getting a utilization rate below 70%. And there's no substitute for that CDBG, but that's not what we're going to get. And I also saw that Dr. Carson has questioned the whole premise of the Fair Housing Act, and it's under the Obama administration, its enforcement. So we're in for a long ride here, I think, on housing.
Yeah, you stipulated it's a spectrum.
I'd like to suggest that we add under the protecting local decision making respect for sovereign tribes, and particularly with regard to obviously the Dakota pipeline, but. Since the city under Mayor Hales has advanced our understanding of tribal rights and government, it would be nice to have that on our list.
Suggestions, additions, enhancements. Okay, good job, team. Let's move on to the state level.
Thank you.
Many questions to answer in Washington.
Great. So I'd like to invite up the state legislative team at this point. And while they're coming up, I do just want to, for anyone who's actually listening to this discussion at home, the drafts that we're going over will actually be posted on the government relations website later today. And that's www.portlandoregon.gov/OGR. And we'll have the slides that we're going over, as well as the agendas. So now turning to the state agenda, we began the process and our call for issues with state legislative agenda back in June, just a couple of months after the legislature adjourned in their short session. Since then, we've been working with each of the bureaus to refine concepts and do quite a bit more research reach out to a lot of other governmental, business, and nonprofit organizations to find some potential alignments for the coming session. We've also been doing several meetings with our legislative delegation to try to get a sense of what are the major issues that would be brought forward in 2017 and how they could impact the city of Portland. So the last thing I'm going to mention before we start our presentation on the state agenda is last week we had the great privilege of having a very successful Advocacy 101 event with Commissioner Fritz. And thanks to her office and thanks to the Office of Neighborhood Involvement and my team in government relations, we, for the very first time, held this community training event outside the central city. We had over 80 people at Tabor Space. It was very well attended. And we had this all-star panel of experts really helping to build the community's capacity for advocacy, including Senator-elect Lou Frederick, Representative Carla Peluso, Andrea Miller from CAUSA, and Carmen Ford from the governor's office. And immediately following that event, Commissioner Fritz and Commissioner-elect Hugh Daly held a listening session just to hear what issues are on the minds of community members. And we did a system by which we really got a sense of which of these issues that we are talking about for inclusion in the agenda are important to them. Know we're going through the data now. We did hear a lot of interest in housing and different aspects of housing and transportation, and I know there's some other big issues that we look forward to sharing with you. So, Commissioner?
Actually, my team have got their numbers for us,
fantastic.
Even as we speak. So we did tell them what we were already thinking about from the bureaus. The biggest number of votes was for rent stabilization, and then no just cause evictions was also the second highest. And really just a lot of interest across the board, including for cell phone tower radiation pollution, which got the same number of votes as funding for housing. So it was just showing that we had a wide range of people. Most of the people who attended had not attended a training session before, although many of them had done some lobbying at the state, and we've got a lot of feedback and very much appreciate government relations partnering with us, Office of Neighborhood Involvement as well. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Commissioner. Right before we kick off our PowerPoint presentation, I do want to acknowledge each of the legislative liaisons in the bureaus and offices. Our liaisons in each bureau have been working extremely hard on developing this agenda and making sure that these concepts are well researched. So just a big thank you to those folks. And with that, I will turn the presentation over to Elizabeth.
Thanks, Martha. I don't have a button here. Okay, it's on. Elizabeth Edwards with the Office of Government Relations. I'm the State Government Relations Manager. And I'm going to start by walking us through a quick timeline of events at both the state and city level. Then we'll cover some context to help frame up the session, human, budget, and some themes that are developing, and then we'll dive right into the draft state agenda. So with that, we have interim legislative days coming up next week, and there will be another set of legislative days, actually technically called organizational days, in January. That's a time for committees to get together for 3 days in a row to review committee business, and when they're getting this late in interim, it's typically to tee up concepts for the next legislative session. So we'll be down there every day working on your behalf and working on items in the agenda. So legislative session will start February 1st, that's on a Wednesday, and the constitutional deadline, also called sine die, is on July 12th. So they could wrap up sooner, but they need to be out by that point unless they have a two-thirds vote to extend. So we will come back to you in January for adoption of the legislative agenda. But also in January is the swearing in of new members. So on January 9th, we'll have the swearing in, and there are quite a few new members. And I'll get to some of those folks that are actually from the Portland area in just a moment. But taking a quick snapshot overview of the legislature, and actually I'll start with the executive branch. Kate Brown was reelected, and we had some changeover in some of the other statewide held offices. We have a new treasurer-elect, Tobias Reed, and a new secretary of state-elect, Dennis Richardson, and the Boley commissioner and attorney general remain the same. And speaking of remaining the same, the legislative leadership at the highest levels in both the House and Senate also look identical from the 2016 session. So Senate President Peter Courtney, Speaker Tina Kotek, are both leading their chambers. We have a lot of leadership from Portland when you look at the majority leaders in both chambers, as well as Speaker Tina Kotek. And then looking at the actual breakdown, you have Democrats with majorities in both chambers. On the House, it's still 35-25. That's the same as last session. And on the Senate side, it's 17-13. The significance of these numbers is that both chambers are one vote shy of a supermajority. Supermajority is that three-fifths vote that's needed in order to pass what's called a revenue-raising measure. In common terms, it's a new tax or a tax increase. So when we're looking ahead to a potential transportation package in 2017, it means it needs to be bipartisan. So I made reference to new legislators. We have five new senators. In fact, we have an open seat right now in Lane County. Lane County commissioners will be meeting to appoint a replacement for Senator Chris Edwards' position. And we have 14 new representatives. Interesting and sort of wonderful fact, for the first time, the House Democratic Caucus is over 50% female, and this is the largest incoming class of people of color in the Oregon legislature that we've ever seen. As far as those folks from Portland that are going to be new, our two new senator-elects are actually from the House, so they'll just be traveling across the legislature. So you have Senator-elect Lou Frederick and Senator-elect Kathleen Taylor. And then on the House side, we have our members listed here, Janelle Bynum, Diego Hernandez, Karim Power, and Thomas Sanchez. Representative-elect Power and Sanchez are both replacing seats that were vacated by now Senator-elect Frederick and Taylor. And Janelle Bynum is coming in to replace Representative Shamia Fagan, and Diego Hernandez is coming in to replace Representative Jessica Vega Peterson. So that's the overview of what's shifted, especially in our neck of the woods. I'm going to turn it over to Dan now. I've covered the human element. Dan's going to shift and talk about what budget context we're going into.
Good afternoon. Dan Eisenbeis, state lobbyist with the Office of Government Relations. Mayor-elect Wheeler already alluded to the state budget and some of the challenges facing the state. I want to take a few minutes to talk about that, because it will be a topic of significant attention in the upcoming session. Last Thursday, Governor Brown released her recommended budget for the 2017-19 biennium. That is based on a projected budget shortfall of $1.7 billion of combined general fund and lottery fund for continuing current service levels. She has proposed to address that through a combination of targeted revenue increases, targeted cuts, and strategic investments. I want to call out a few of the highlights from that budget. It includes $8.6 billion for early childhood and K through 12 education, as well as $50 million proposed for access to higher education. That's both continuing the Oregon promise of free community college attendance for high school students who maintain a certain GPA, as well as financial aid for four-year universities. In healthcare, the governor's budget proposes to continue Oregon Health Plan coverage at the same level that it has been at in the past, as well as expand healthcare for all Oregon children. In the area of affordable housing, the governor's budget proposes $60 million in new funding for development of additional affordable housing units through the low-income and fast-track program created by the legislature in 2015. The budget also includes $10 million for housing preservation and $300 million to provide assistance for first-time homebuyers with their loans. In the area of economic development, the governor's budget proposes $10 million to jumpstart action on cleanup of the Portland Harbor Superfund site, as well as $50 million for local public works projects, including $10 million dedicated for levy certification efforts. And the budget also proposes investments in seismic resiliency, including $160 million for retrofits of schools in Oregon, as well as $40 million for retrofits of emergency service buildings. On the next slide, there is a chart showing the trend in the state revenue forecast. The trend recently has been that the revenues have held relatively stable for the projection in 2017-19. However, the revenue projection has decreased by approximately $50 million in each of the last couple revenue forecasts. I note that because this is in the context of Oregon's economy continuing to be relatively strong. State economists have noted that if the economy were to slow more than expected, there would be downside risk for the state budget.
So we've talked about the people and we've talked about the budget. Now we're going to transition into talking a little bit about some of the themes that are popping up for this upcoming session. And I think it's appropriate that we just came off of the budget because that is one of the major themes ahead of us in 2017. You'll see a series of issues that really sort of are related to the pressures that the state is starting to feel, including PERS, tax reform, mental health funding, education funding, all these relate to the pressures that are being put on the budget right now. Another item I'll call out is transportation funding. Both the executive and legislative branches have been doing statewide tours over the interim,